We're going behind the scenes at the Geneva Auto Show, figuring out how many cylinders you've got in your household and where in the world this auto industry is headed.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 186 for March 8, 2013. The supercar segment has hit its peak. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Mr. DeLorenzo.
John, another opening and another show.
We keep doing this every week, man.
Yeah.
So, and we should tell the audience, too, we're also being joined by, right off the plane from the Geneva Motor Show, Paul Eisenstein.
Oh, hi.
Freelancer extraordinaire. And Michael Robinette. And let's see, the head analyst at IHS?
Pretty
for
well.
For automotive.
Pretty well these days, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so. And good having you here back.
Thank you, John.
It's been a while, but it's
been
cool
a while
to have you back here.
And I'll throw in, by the way, that I was doing it primarily for the DetroitBureau.com, but also for NBCNews.com, which I am now their auto editor.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, Peter, what'd you write about this week? What was your column about?
Really the reality of the infighting inside the car companies, that you have the visionaries and the true believers against the miserable twerps and spineless weasels. And it really hasn't changed. I mean, there's still deep-rooted fiefdoms in these companies that resist change. And it's not just the vast gray middle, as Lutz used to refer to it. There is rampant incompetence at the director level and above in a lot of these companies.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote about that.
Yeah.
To your point, I'll say that this was just an extremely high-level person at Ford Motor Company. We'll leave it there, who I was talking to about, you know, we're looking at moving towards a transition right now. Do you guys feel confident that you have really, Mullally has put this change in place? Because it's obviously it was the most political of the companies. And he said, no, at best we're halfway through.
Hmm.
And this was from somebody who was usually out drumming, beating the drum, saying how great we are. But, I mean, the moment of candor was just saying there's huge issues still to get people to believe and to make the changes and accept this. And they'll go right back to the political ways of the old if they're not careful.
That may be, but I got to tell you, from my view of from afar, not being in the company, Ford's probably farther ahead than anybody else in the
company.
I don't disagree with you.
But you're just saying solved.
You also have to remember, you know, you can have things where people get true. When they're true believer, it's easy to be a true believer when everything's right. It's very easy to go back to old ways when things aren't. Hmm. And Ford right now is generally moving ahead very aggressively. But we've also seen that there's a bunch of stuff that can bite them. There's quality issues. We don't know what's happening with Lincoln. Lincoln right now is, you know, it's not working the way they thought it would even and then you have the fuel economy thing, which could be a disaster if this thing gets worse.
Right. The thing about Lincoln, though, it's really one car. It's the MKZ.
Yeah, it's a product problem and lack thereof.
And it's it's also a product cadence problem. And
yes. Yeah.
But right now, Lincoln sales are down strictly because of the MKZ.
Right.
I mean, if MKZ could even just match a year ago sales, they'd be up as a brand.
Right.
So it's the build problems that they're having with that car.
Right. They insist that they'll be in dealership showrooms en masse in April. So,
well, you know, I remember writing, and I think we've all written to some degree, and you probably talked about it only a few months ago. We were saying, you know, ATS, it's slow, things aren't good, Cadillac ended the year, not looking good. So to your point, if they get them in the showroom and people do, in fact, buy them, then suddenly, all of a sudden, we just say, oh, well, it was a problem, but look at how well they're doing. So that can turn around real quickly, maybe.
It can, but Michael, you were saying that earlier that a lot of product programs are slipping now across the industry.
It's rampant.
It's a big, big issue in the industry right now. You talk to any number of suppliers, and they'll tell you that FPPs, future product programs, are slipping. They might slip by 3 months, it might slip by 6 months, but when they slip a year out by 3 months, that's a big deal because you've already put capital in place, you've already bought machines, you've already ordered tooling, you're training people, and then you're waiting to build parts. It's like, oh, sorry, I don't need you for another 3 months. Hey, wait a minute, I could have been building something else on this machine and making a lot more money than it sitting here and doing nothing.
So why are they slipping?
Slipping for a lot of reasons. I think some of it is just the mass of the number of vehicle launch events that are going on right now is unbelievable. That's the number one.
And how many are coming? Because I know you know these. Just give us
in North America, we're pushing over the between 2012 to 16, we're pushing almost 100 events. That's basically a launching a vehicle at a plant. That's an unbelievable amount. And if you think about what happened, it's interesting to go back to the genesis. So we had 08, everybody was going, oh my gosh, what's going on? Chrysler, GM, et cetera, et cetera. 09, we obviously had the bankruptcies. Nobody's spending money. So what happens is you don't spend money in any tooling. Well, it's not so much you're not going to launch product in 09. You're going to launch it anyways because it's ready. It's stuff that's coming out in late 10 and 11 that got pushed. Yeah. So basically the product curves went like this in 11. And then, of course, in 10, they realize, oh, the world's not going away. Oh my gosh, start the money machine again. Get the toolers going. And that's why 12 was unbelievable. And everybody's going, oh, I can't handle all this activity. So there's launch issues. Suppliers can't find enough engineers. OEMs can't find enough engineers. I contend that a couple of OEMs that we've talked about here, they retired a lot of people in middle management that knew how to launch vehicles. You know, people that have been around for 20 years that knew, oh, that fender looks like that. Six stations down, I can tell you what's going on. And that just comes with experience. And
institutional knowledge.
And when you lose that, it's a big deal. You end up having to find out all over again what the problem is. So there's a lot of issues.
How much of the issue with the MKZ is related to losing institutional knowledge?
Some of it might be. I think with that is that they launched Fusion. MKZ came pretty close behind. I think there's a lot of issues. There might be some suppliers that weren't ready for, you know, because they were really moving Fusion pretty strong. Mm-hmm. And then here along came MKZ, which, you know, complete different outer exterior, complete different interior. Some of the componentry is somewhat different. So it you're not building a completely different car, but it's different enough. It's not another body style of Fusion, let's put it that way. And so it's different enough that I think it caused some headaches at the plant. They're just going to have to work their way through it.
Yeah. But, of course, if next month they have cars in the showrooms, we'll forget all about this. It won't be... Yeah.
And Ford knows that, and other OEMs know that, too.
Taking a long view is not something Detroit is traditionally adept at. I mean, it's everyone's looking at their watches and saying, well, what have you done for us lately?
The long-term view is the end of the quarter.
And oh, you go that far out?
You're thinking like a car dealer.
Yeah. Because then the talk at the upper levels of the company becomes, oh, we really need to get this fixed. And then eventually there's one person who hears, you need to get this fixed now. So we'll see. I mean, you know, the launch was a problem because all the marketing push played out 2 months early. I mean, I'm sure if Matt Van Dyke had to do it over again, he would have had the Lincoln launch come on the Grammys and the Oscars and not on the Super Bowl.
Right.
I mean, just push it all back. But, you know, that's the big thing. There's a big problem with getting the vehicles launched. Then the perennial problem is, boy, can we mesh this marketing launch better?
Well, and you just hit on something very important. We've seen this in a couple times in recent years, sometimes with the domestics and sometimes with the Japanese, where the syncopation fell apart and there was a launch. I think the Civic was probably a good example.
Yeah.
You know, the car didn't work out right. They had all this money out there. They sort of try to pull back. So is Lincoln going to be in a bind right now where they're going to have to come up with some money to do a relaunch? And if so, how much is it going to cost?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think a relaunch is necessary, but I think they will activate at the dealer level with the MKZ and have some halo spots out there. But now is the time. The Lincoln dealers have been patient and they're upset And now they have product, and it's now like, okay, boys.
Well, let me ask you another question about that. We've heard a lot of criticism of the Lincoln campaign. So in some senses, might this be a good thing? Because if the advertising wasn't working as well as they thought.
No, I think the advertising is working fine.
Do you?
I think the program really played out well. I think, you know, you're not going to reposition Lincoln overnight. They launched the Lincoln Motor Company, and it's a slow build, and they know that. And I think they made some headway. I think there was some, they were less than happy with how the Super Bowl played out, and they know that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the work up to there was not to be tossed out. And actually, they had some stuff on the Grammys that was really good. Mm-hmm. So I expect to see more of that. And, you know, it's not the end of the world there. It didn't go like they wanted. But as you said, I mean, lots of things, they're not going like they're planned right now. And, you know,
I think the mettle of a company is how you react to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's where we are right now.
And I'll tell you the truth. I truly contend that Lincoln's not going to have the ability to have a global presence until they've got a good C car. You've got a good C car. You know, you only attract to certain markets. Europeans, you know, they've got D cars all over the place.
Well, what did you think of the MKC that they showed at the Detroit show?
I liked it. I didn't think anything really set it apart from its competition. I thought everything on it looked relatively good. Powertrain wasn't really different than what you can get in most other vehicles. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was adequate. I was hoping for something a little bit better. It's like I said, I can't wait until they actually do a good C car, you know, something mm-hmm. that will be competitive up against ATS and 3 Series. That to me that's where the volume is, and that's truly where you can go global.
Would you guys have, in retrospect, would you have gone and say, don't do the MKC crossover first, but go to a C sedan first?
The problem is it's all about money, because the Focus was already, the cake was baked, and you really couldn't pull it off of Focus. They had a lot of other things going on, so they said, well, we can pull something off of the Escape. Let's do that, and then we'll have to wait our turn to do a C car. Let's learn some lessons to do a C car. I think if they had their druthers, they would probably, you know, put some money aside and do a C car and do a good C car. Yeah. But, you know, it's next time.
Let me ask you more about that, because if you don't mind me jumping in on this. But
go.
In December at the holiday party that they had for the media, I was really stunned. I went over to Mr. Mullally, and I said, you can't just go with the 4 products you have. I know you're working on a few other things, but I don't know if you've approved them, including the rear drive vehicle that I'm absolutely certain you have in place. And he said, yes, we do. And yes, I've approved them, and I'm not going to tell you anymore. So we confirmed that there's a bunch more products that are not only already in development, but have already been given approval, and he confirmed the rear drive. So, okay, where are we? From what you know, what are the other products besides a Mustang-based, next-generation Mustang-based vehicle?
I think, you know, it's like I said, there will be a C sedan, but you won't see anything before 16. I mean, let's
that's
face
the time
it.
Frame.
And the market's different, because Mercedes, with their new
CLA,
for $30,000 on the sticker, at least that's what they're saying.
But think about Cafe. By 16 or 17, it really starts to hike up. I mean, that's when you really start to need a smaller car.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be very important. So,
although there is the review in 17, and if I'm right, I'm getting really geeked on this natural gas and mm-hmm. liquid propane, not for retail customers, but for commercial fleets.
But John, think about a review. Okay, so you're in Washington, and the OEMs get in, they drive their cars, they don't take their private planes to Washington, and they decide, you get a situation where they start talking about, well, we'd like to have a review in 17 and 18 about CAFE, and the government says, fine, we'll have a review. So they all sit down, and it's not a one-month process. It takes 6 months, 9 months, a year, and then they realize, okay, we're going to lighten up the load a little bit on CAFE, we're going to lower the standards a little bit, and the OEMs go, great. And then they realize, oh my gosh,
we've already designed.
The cake's been baked all the way to 21. So we contend at IHS, it doesn't matter. Basically, we're in a stream till 22. And then after 22, if things get dialed down a little bit, then electrification, they might see a little bit less. But we're in the stream till 22. Easy.
Mm. Well, you can still make adjustments. And you can still flex production. The cake will be baked for all the different products. I totally agree. But you can flex things at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
that's not to the CAFE law, but to what people actually want to buy in the showroom.
Well, certainly mix is the thing.
Mix can change, don't get me wrong. But if somebody says, I'm going to put a plug-in into this vehicle, and they're waiting for the review, you can't wait.
But here's the other thing. I was very interested to see that passenger car sales actually fell last month. Small car sales fell last month. This is when gas prices in the U.S. are shooting up. Mm-hmm. And that's what everyone's always said. It's not the price. It's the rate of increase.
Right.
Well, we just saw a hell of a rate of increase, and small car sales dropped. So, you know, this is what I'm saying is I think there will be a review in 2017. And my guess at this snapshot in time is we do start to back off it. Because CAFE was put in place to get this country off imported oil. And guess what? That's happening real fast.
I'll tell you what, though. You have to remember that it's more and more of a global situation now. Carlos Ghosn in Geneva was saying that it is going to be the Chinese who will push electrification worldwide.
I completely agree.
Wait
a minute. But what about these studies that show if China goes heavily on electric cars, they get something like 70% of their electricity from coal, the emissions get even farther.
Perception, reality, this gap. And right now, the Chinese seem to have convinced themselves they've got to go electric, and everybody and anybody I talk to over there, that's where they're going.
I agree, Paul, but they've also got a severe pollution problem.
I realize.
And
that.
If all of a sudden they realize, oh, my God, it's getting worse, what the hell are you going to do then?
Well, at this point, remember, this is a country that's still trying to figure out how to balance between the bureaucrats, the new leaders, and the public.
Yeah.
And this is one case where you have almost all of them coming together saying, we can't tolerate what's happened before. I don't want to get too far off on China. That's another subject we can do. But the key is that's going to drive the market. Europe now is engaging. What was fascinating to me, I spent a lot of time with various VW people, and particularly Audi, while I was over at the Geneva show. And what I found was a huge commitment by them to electrification in general. Of course, we saw the 261 mile per gallon XL1. But
European driving cycle, yes, 261.
Yeah. Yes, 18 miles a gallon here.
Right.
But the thing was, they are planning to roll out an assault of plug-ins in particular. Dr. Hollerweger, who's the head of Audi's technical development, said point blank, we have it on the DetroitBureau.com, a story went up today, that they are going to be adding a new plug-in after the A3 Sportback every year, at least one a year. And what's interesting is, so you've got Porsche, which is coming up with how many battery vehicles? VW coming up with how many battery vehicles? Audi coming up. And then you have, again, another story that we did today was having the head, Dr. Frech, of Bentley confirming not only that they'll do the SUV, but they are going to do that plug-in. It'll be around 2015 or 2016. But Bentley is now locked into doing a plug-in hybrid. So to your point, I don't think these people are going to back down.
Let's talk about the Chinese for a second.
Okay.
Irrespective of the downstream, you know, well-to-wheel type of considerations, let's just put that aside for a second, okay? If the Chinese said, let's just say tomorrow there's a story that comes out that says, by the way, as part of the next five-year plan, in 5 years, we want to be 50% electric. Think about what that does to the economies of scale of this industry. It is unbelievable. That means that 10 million vehicles per year will be electric.
It's
just think about the R&D that would have to be channeled in that direction for all these OEMs like GM and Chrysler and Volkswagen to make sure they meet those standards. China's the one country that can change the root of this automotive industry.
It can, and they've been trying. And as a consumer in China right now, you can get a $19,000 discount on any electric car that you want to buy. And I think that the total number last year in China was about 8,000 vehicles.
But if the government mandates it, different story. Completely different story.
And here's the thing. You know, again, a story. We were talking before we got on air about something that we did a few days ago on the Detroit Bureau. And one of the stories came out of a report that I first saw in Deutsche Bank and have spoken to Mike Dunn, who we all know, and a few others. And there is growing belief in China by people in and around the industry and some people elsewhere, that they are going to just simply, plain and simple, put the brakes on the industry. It's growing too fast. There's a bunch of issues with it. Pollution is a major issue, traffic obviously as well. And depending on how they view it, depending on how they decide to deal with it, electrification is almost certainly going to be one of the major solutions. It may be the only solution. That may be the way that they take, which could be basically you guys aren't building anything else or you're only building this much.
I still maintain that if pollution gets worse, they're going to have to back off that.
Well, they're going to have to at least adjust their advertising tourism campaign to welcome to China, the emphysema capital of the world.
Oh, my God.
I remember I went to the 08 Beijing Auto Show, and I was leaving, and as my plane was coming up to the runway, I saw the plane in front of me take off because we were sideways. I'm looking out the window. It took off. I literally heard it take off, but it went into a cloud and took off. I did not see it take off. That's how much smog was at that airport. Something else.
To your point when we were chatting earlier, going to the auto show last year, and thinking it was fog, San Francisco-style fog, and realizing it was just crud. I could literally grab the crud out of the air.
Right.
I sat down at the auto show. They had a little outdoor courtyard. I sat down, and when I stood up, my pants were just completely coated.
Yeah, I believe it. And this is why I'm saying unless or until China changes how it generates electricity to make it not as dirty as it is, there's no way that electric cars are going to catch on there. Can't happen because people are already deeply upset with the system producing so much pollution. And there's several studies that show that if you have more electric cars using more electricity, burning more coal, it's only going to get worse.
Well, the question is, what can they do? Because they can't. One of the solutions that's not necessarily, this may be the best one for the industry, is you just go there and you say, we are doing the equivalent of a cash for clunkers deal. And all those vehicles, those old vehicles with no pollution from 5 years ago.
No pollution control.
From 5 years ago, you're going to trade them in, and here's all the...
undoubtedly, that would help. I mean, look, you know, they have enormous hydroelectric power there. You know, maybe the next step is we keep electric cars, but we don't run the electricity out of batteries. We generate it with a fuel cell. Now, that's where I could see electric cars catching on in
China. The question is, where do they get the fuel source?
How do you manufacture your hydrogen?
As a good Canadian, we're happy to keep sending them coal. So,
yeah. And as Americans, we'd be happy to send them natural gas now.
Well, no, we'll send them the coal. We'll keep the natural gas. Oh, you just got off. I mean, literally, the plane landed, you got in the car, and you drove here to the show. What really stood out in your mind? Just bang. Don't
bang,
think.
Bang,
answer.
Well, obviously, everybody was standing in front of La Ferrari. That was an amazing vehicle. Though, while it didn't get...
What do you think? To me, Peter, to me, it looks over-designed.
Yeah, and the problem is, if that's LaFerrari, then are they done?
Yeah.
Is that it? That's the Ferrari? Is it done?
How do you say in Italian, even more the Ferrari?
Yeah, I don't know what they're going to do. I mean, sure, it's spectacular, but then I begin to wonder, look, we have the Ferrari, we have the McLaren, we have the upcoming Porsche, we already have the Bugatti Veyron. I mean, 900 horsepower and up. I mean, I think the supercar, I think we've reached
the
point.
Peak.
Yeah. And I'm going to write about this next week. I'm going to write about the future of the supercar and where I think it should go.
Well, I want to read that. And I'll tell you a story that I'm working on for The Economist, who I write for. And that's the quirky thing about this show. The big topic was, of course, the collapse of the industry. As Carlos Ghosn pointed out, he went into the year for Renault and Nissan figuring it would be a 3-5% decline this year. Well, they're running as much as 8% in Europe, and there's no sign that's just a temporary aberration for the first 2 months. So if this is an 8% decline, it's a disaster. It's already a mess. Now it's a disaster. And yet, what do? We go to Geneva.
And look at LaFerrari.
And a $4 million Veneto or whatever they call it.
Veneno.
I mean, you can't even remember the name of it, right?
I do, because that actually means poison.
Actually, it's what's the name of a bull too? As yeah. all of them are.
And Lamborghini, that's they built four,
three.
Three and two are sold to Americans.
Right. Hmm. But here's the thing. So you've got the $4 million Veneno. You've got the million some P1. You've got the 499 LaFerraris. And you've got the Rolls-Royce Wraith and on and on and on. But what you don't have is anybody buying mainstream cars. Is there something that's a disconnect here,
well,
or is
you know,
it just
Geneva,
me?
It's, you know, they, you have to bring, as a manufacturer, you have to bring your show ponies out to Geneva because it wouldn't be an auto show. And this LaFerrari has been in the works for 3 years,
easy.
Mm-hmm. And everyone thought it was going to be the 700 or something. But, you know, it's spectacular and it's cool. And for, what is it going to be, a million?
About 1.6 million.
Yeah, and they're going to make 499 of them. And, you know, I just think, okay, you guys can do that. If you have, I mean, the McLaren, I think the P1 is awesome. It's gorgeous and all of that stuff. At the technical, I mean, they're just in another world. But, you know, I just think we need to press the reset button on supercars.
Well, here's the other interesting thing about supercars, though. If you look at many, but not all, of the real high-end vehicles, both supercars and luxury cars, as I mentioned, Porsche going to plug-in.
They become technology test beds, and that's what supercars used to be.
Yeah.
Corvette, they would try, you know, new technologies on Corvette and then blend them into the mass market. And then we got away from that. And I think that at some point we're going to come back to it. If you look at like a 959, God love it, quirky car, but, you know, it was years ahead of its time. It was a technology test bed. A lot of technologies in that vehicle eventually found its way into other Porsche vehicles. And I think that's where supercars at some point need to go.
But
that's
how interesting. They're all going green. I mean, all these vehicles, all of the ones that we saw heard about
have
the Hiker system on the P1, the Formula One-derived Hiker system on the McLaren P1 and on the LaFerrari. We'll have the plug-in on the Bentley. We have how many different types of electrification are we seeing in Porsche over the next few years? So that's intriguing to me that, to your point, once again, these guys, well, and one of the things that's important is a lot of these folks who buy these cars, they can afford it. They want to look green. And they're willing to spend the money. But here's another issue that came up, and you heard this all over Geneva. What's really scaring people right now, what's scaring a lot of folks in the industry, is the danger of having all sorts of megacities lock them out. Mm. You know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, yeah, look.
They started in London.
It started in London. There's other city centers in Europe where you're not allowed to take a car.
And the McLaren release addressed that. Mm-hmm. They said when you go into some of those urban centers, you can put it on full electric and you can go anywhere.
And you're legal.
Right. And so that's what a lot of these folks are looking at, the option. And interestingly enough, there's one maker, Audi, is looking at an alternate, but they haven't been able to, they haven't worked with legislators yet. But they're hoping, I mentioned Dr. Hollewegger, and he was saying that he's hoping that their gas vehicle, their e-gas, which is an interesting project, it is so low, they're claiming 30 grams per kilometer. That regulators will allow that version of an internal combustion engine to get the same benefits.
And that's natural gas?
It's natural gas, but what's real interesting is that Audi has this project going in northern, and this gets to what you were talking about with China. Okay, could this sort of system work? What they're doing is they have this natural gas vehicle, the G-Tron, and the first, was it 15,000 customers? I have to, no, I'm sorry, 1,500 will be able to get a contract for basically a clean version, a natural gas biofuel. What they're doing is they're working with the largest utility in Germany. They are taking energy from a fields of windmills. When they're producing in off hours, they get next to nothing. They're using that to take either CO2 out of the air or CO2 sequestered from, say, a cement plant. They split water. They electrolyze water. They take the hydrogen with the CO2. They put them back together. So they take, if you will, used fuel to create new natural gas, and they pump it into the system. And because you're using CO2 that would otherwise go in the air, it's essentially like you're putting out essentially almost a renewable fuel.
Yeah, that's a fascinating approach. Hmm. But you got to have the infrastructure for that, too.
Well,
that's why I still say, you know, Europe is very well set up, southern Europe especially, for autogas, which is propane, liquid propane.
And Germany for natural gas.
Is it? Okay.
About 1,000 stations, and they're looking to have 15.
Mm-hmm. So, but to my thinking, you know, if you got a pretty good infrastructure in place, why don't you just push all the way with that instead of trying to think up something totally, completely new? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember Anne Asensio, who used to be at GM Design. She's now living in Paris working for Dassault Systems. She drives a Chevrolet Tahoe. And, you know, that's like the Uber SUV that earns the enmity of all French people, you know. Not only is it an SUV, God damn it, it's an American SUV. But it runs on autogas.
And oh, really?
She loves bragging to her friends that her carbon footprint driving this big American SUV is smaller than them driving their little Twingos or whatever they're in. So just kind of interesting.
So you mentioned CNG. So that's actually quite interesting because there is Ackerson at the IHS CERA conference,
right,
which is the big energy conference that we hold. I haven't had an invitation yet, but I'm hoping to go at one point. But Ackerson
working for the company, they ought to invite you, and you're the automotive analyst for them. Yeah, you bet.
So, but Ackerson basically said, you know, first of all, we don't have an energy policy, which of course is completely true.
Yeah.
And then the second one is, you know, we think that CNG can go places, and it's actually quite interesting. You need the real estate. It's all about real estate on the vehicle. Where can you put the tanks? And then the infrastructure after that. But, you know, you still use the ICE. The delivery mechanism's pretty similar. There's not a lot that's different. So if you got the infrastructure and the real estate on the vehicle, you got something to work with.
There's going to be a real battle between CNG, compressed natural gas, and liquid propane.
LPG,
I was just at International's website. You know, they make the big Class 8 semis. Mm-hmm. You can get an LPG.
Yes.
Class 8 semi now.
Ackerson talked about in the speech yesterday.
And they've got a cost calculator. So you can plug in what's the price of diesel in your area, what's the price of LPG in your area, how many miles are you going to drive a year, and how many years are you going to own it. And they have it set up for, here's what the typical truck does.
Yeah.
$380,000 savings over a 10-year period.
How much?
$380,000.
That's somebody's retirement.
It's over 30. It's $38,000 a year that you would save as a fleet owner if you own that truck.
What's the cost? Because I thought Ackerson said something like 2 to 3 years payback period.
That's if you buy at commercial pump prices. If, as a fleet owner, you go to an industrial source and say, "Hey, I'll bring my whole fleet here. Let's sign a contract for 5 years," it drops to 80 cents a gallon equivalent.
Yeah. Oh.
So, I mean,
it's a big deal.
And the $380,000 savings, I'm counting retail pump prices at $250 a gallon. Mm. And that's because these guys will run their trucks 100,000 miles a year. Yeah. So the savings per mile, I mean, it adds up real fast.
Well, I want to get back to that thing I told you about with Audi. Mm-hmm. Now, we have massive fields of if fracking continues, and there's a lot of opposition to it. Governor Cuomo.
So it doesn't get done in New York.
All right, but
it's
the point is,
grow like crazy.
But the point is, there are people who are trying. They may take it to court. We don't know what'll happen.
Yeah.
There's some negative studies. The question is, we could conceivably take all sorts, power plants and the like. You know, there's been talk about sequestering CO2 and all sorts of things. What about the idea? Could this be a viable point where we take CO2 from the sources and we wind up using energy from green energy, wave energy, who knows what, to start essentially recreating that stuff back into a liquid or gaseous fuel again?
I think it's a fascinating concept. It sounds like it's got a lot of merit. But again, what are the economics? And again, You know, 5 years ago, we were never talking about this natural gas bonanza. We were never talking about the United States going back to being the number one oil producer in the world again. We never were talking about that.
You know what the big problem we're having?
What?
Can't move this stuff. We have no pipeline. So you're in North Dakota and South Dakota, and they've got all these little shunt railways that are trying to move the oil. And by the way, if whoever buy stock in an oil tanker car making is...
is going to make some money.
Well, yeah. But anyways, but make a long story short, that's why one of the reasons for having Keystone is not so much to get the oil sands oil down here. It's all about North and South Dakota. They've got nowhere to ship it. Everything's by rail, and it's economic, but not as economic as putting it into a pipeline and let it go on all on its own.
And I don't know if you saw, there was a big article in the Wall Street Journal 2 days ago about Burlington Northern and other rails now looking at running their locomotives on natural gas.
Oh, really?
They are starting a test program. Caterpillar and GE are building engines for locomotives, diesel engines that run on natural gas.
Yep.
So, I mean, and they not don't for have... retail customers, but for fleets right. and big rail companies.
But even for fleets, think of the possibilities. One of the problems with gas is the fact that, you know, refilling in the infrastructure. But if you got a station in Grand Rapids, you got, you know, some in Detroit, you got some in Port Huron, as long as you know you can get from A to B, then that's actually half the battle.
Mm-hmm. Right. I ran into a couple of interesting companies. One is called, I want to say it's GNV or NVG. But anyway, they go around and look, and they have a big map of the United States. They see where all the truck fleets are. Then they go into where there's a cluster of fleets, and they look for the big natural gas pipelines in that area. And then they look at the map and see what gas stations are near that pipeline. Then they go to the fleets and say, hey, if we can get you a source to fill up all your trucks, would you go to natural gas? And they all go, yeah. Then they go to the gas station owner and say, we're going to build it right on the site. We're going to tap into the line, and here's all your customers.
Well, you know, there's another thing that's happening. I just heard about this the other day. You may have even reported on it before. I believe it's Honeywell, but I'm not absolutely certain, who has come up with a much lower cost compression system for home use, faster and cheaper, something like $500. So suddenly, instead of having to do, you can only do maybe one fill up every day.
Oh, you mean for filling your car at home?
Right. This is the other thing that people forget about, is that what percentage of Americans have natural gas in the home? Part of the problem has been that the cost of home pumps, very high, several thousand dollars, and they're very slow. They can do it best once a day. Apparently, this system changes the equation. You could do it repeatedly, very fast and very cheap, like $500. Mm-hmm. And that changes the game for civilians, as it were. By the way, who is one of the big proponents, a former auto industry guy who's a big proponent for natural gas? Harvey Lamb.
Oh, really? The guy who started Subaru?
Subaru, yeah.
Very interesting.
He has a company out east that's been trying to do mostly fleet, but he's been a major proponent of natural gas vehicles for a long time.
Very
one thing about natural gas is that the infrastructure of the internal combustion engine continues. So if you're an OEM, you don't have to build another engine plant. You just got to make sure it runs on a different fuel.
Just have to harden the valve seats, essentially.
Yeah, essentially, that's one of the big problems, is the heat of the engine. So,
well, it's not even the heat. It's that natural gas
dry.
And it's dry.
Right,
exactly,
right,
Paul.
Right.
You don't get the lubricity that you do in gasoline or diesel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, one other topic that we wanted to jump on here that we've got you, Michael, is materials.
Mm-hmm.
Different materials coming into cars. That's something I know that you've been studying.
It's really interesting, and of course, when we found out a couple of years ago about what our friends over at Ford were going to be doing with the F-Series, I mean, you start to kind of...
The aluminum truck, right?
And you start to think about it, and you think to yourself, my gosh, that's 700 pounds you're going to save, 700, 750, whatever it turns out to be. And all that exterior sheet, and probably inners and exterior sheet, plus a couple of cross members will go aluminum. You know, that's the single largest program for aluminum tonnage ever for the automotive industry.
When you consider the volume?
It's unbelievable. Wow. It's 700,000 vehicles, and you start to add up to a lot of aluminum sheet. You know, so Ford, we talked a little bit about sort of the OEMs getting a little stodgy, but that's a hell of a chance. But I think what's interesting, it sets up for one heck of a pickup war, because we saw the K2XX, And that
the GM truck.
The GM trucks are at our lingo, but
I know. But I'm saying that for the audience.
That's okay. So the Sierra and the Silverado, and but that cake's baked all the way till 1920 now.
2020.
Yeah. So until they even think about making any material change with that vehicle, at least of any large volume. And now you got Chrysler. Chrysler's actually in a really interesting spot right now because they just launched sort of a moderate on the Ram.
Right.
And they've got a new Ram coming probably around 16 or so. So they're making decisions right now, knowing what Ford is going to be launching, knowing what GM has already out in the market for the next, 7 or 8 years, easy. So it's interesting. There's some big decisions going on at Auburn Hills right now in terms of what do we do with our pickup? How do we lightweight it? What's the route that we take? What's the competitive structure going to be? Because I contend that GM may have some issues in about 4 or 5 years when Ford's out there with their light vehicle. Chrysler might be out there with something light. And GM's out there going, well, okay, we've got a Workman truck. It does everything it needs to, but it's not competitive from a weight perspective with these other vehicles.
Well, what about the Japanese? And these guys can't seem to get traction. I don't think there was anybody really excited about the Tundra we saw in Chicago. It was like, oh, I'm sorry, was there a new truck here? Nissan is trying to rethink what they were going to do.
In this segment, for good or for bad, the Japanese are just sort of a sideline. It's really all about the...
Could they do something dramatic? I hear that Nissan is thinking about a lot of really interesting alternatives. I don't know about Toyota, if they're even going to try.
I don't know. I think that, you know, Ford, the biggest player, they now become the top banana to
the only thing
after.
Is, I'll say, is that aluminum don't come cheap. You know, it's three times the price of steel.
We'll say this, though.
I think
the guys at Ford...
By cost.
Yeah, I know, but
you use fewer pounds. I see.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think the guys at Ford were smart enough that hopefully they've locked in some longer-term prices, and they know they've hedged. I would be floored if they basically have this floating price that goes up and down like a yo-yo.
Yeah.
To do a program that big, you need some sort of hedge strategy. I don't know for sure. I'm guessing, but I would imagine, knowing some of the economics, that would really have to be the case.
I've heard that they have said over the years that they would only do it, a major project like that, if they could take it out of the commodity speculation world.
Yep. Take the risk out of the equation.
Can you imagine? I mean, there are guys who are drooling at the idea of what that's going to do to demand and what that would do to cost. Yeah. They can't allow that to happen.
I think the bigger issue is do you have, now you have aluminum stamping, which is different than metal stamping. So there's all these new bridges they have to go over. So,
well, would there be different manufacturing processes?
It would. Think of the bonding. Aluminum bonding is different than steel, or aluminum to steel. Now you have new bonding techniques you have to invent. I mean, not invent, but at least to do in mass production.
Yeah.
You know, we're
and
not
pass
building
all the safety standards.
We're not building Audi 8s and Jags here.
Yeah.
We're building 50 pickups an hour. You know, it's a big difference.
All right, so here to me is the real question. It came up during the preview of that concept vehicle, the Atlas. One of the Ford senior guys said to me, the real issue for us isn't necessarily even the cost of the vehicle. It's going to be cost of ownership. Because if the potential buyers of this vehicle are not comfortable with what the potential cost of ownership is going to be, they're not going to go for it. And cost of ownership, yes, fuel matters. But there's a lot of other things. And they're going to have to be able to justify that over the life of this, this is what repairability is going to be. This is durability and so on. So can they make that case?
I think it's a great point. I think I'm pretty sure the guys in Dearborn are aware that, you know, that buyer is going to need to be convinced that aluminum body panels are going to be just as good as steel, that you're not going to have additional repair issues.
Well, look, if anybody understands their customer,
they do.
Nobody understands it better than Ford understands the F-Series buyer.
Yeah.
I mean, they know that cold.
But it's a bold move. I applaud them. I wish them luck. I think they're going to have some success. I think there's going to be some bumps along the way.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish them luck.
Cool. Hey, look, let's take a quick commercial break, and then we'll come back and do rapid fire. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, it's time for rapid fire, the time where we get to all the audience's questions. So, Ben, let it rip. Okay, we got a question from Espo that I'm going to throw to you, Michael. What's your best guess to the model year that the Subaru Outback will be redesigned? Any? Sorry to put you on the spot like that.
Okay. I think we're probably looking at about another, I think it's 3 years or so, or okay. 2 to 3 years, because it just had some work done on it. Well, I think what's interesting, though, and I know we're in rapid fire, but I think what's interesting is obviously Subaru and Toyota are a lot more closer to the hips than before. I wouldn't be surprised that at some point the Boxer engine may have to go bye-bye.
Bye-bye, really?
At some point, because the emissions on a Boxer are a lot more challenging than your average V engine.
No kidding. Yes. Oh, I did not know that. Yes. Ooh, very interesting. Ooh. AM2 says, John, based on your experience with the 1.6 EcoBoost, small turbos are not that fuel efficient in real-world driving. Many small turbos for Ford outside of Europe. Is this a bad move for Ford? That remains to be seen. Ford doesn't seem to have had a problem with small displacement turbos in Europe, so maybe that will not be a problem for it here. But I, as I said, in my experience, my real-world experience, I don't see the fuel economy numbers. That's my experience. Let's see. Glenn E. wants to know, will hydrogen ever catch on?
Interestingly enough, I heard people talking hydrogen again in Geneva. There was even a Hyundai display on hydrogen. I just wrote something recently. I think hydrogen is beginning to regain momentum. But Cho, the energy secretary, in the final few months that he was in office, move a little money back? They'd taken money away from hydrogen to go to electric, and I think they've now moved a little bit back.
That, you're absolutely right. But that was Chu. Cho's from Toyota.
Right, yes.
He's doing hydrogen, too.
Achu. George from Brooklyn says, may I throw this to you, Peter. How many years would it take Lincoln to build a three-series killer? 5 years, he asks?
Yeah, 5 years.
If
you might need two cycles, much. Too. You can't do it. You may not be able to do it in the first cycle. Yeah. You'd need two cycles.
Yeah. No, does ATS is pretty quick getting there, depending on whether you call it a killer or not.
Okay, Scott in Cleveland wants to know, in light of the Opel Kascada convertible coming out, how likely do you think that Buick will come out with the Verano convertible?
Oh, how about never?
There was a lot of talk about that. Nobody seems to believe it's happening.
I got a guy I used to work with that said that there would be a Riviera convertible when the old body style came out, and I said, man, that thing would look bad in a convertible. Let's hope that never happens. So.
Brian Little says GM's goal is to reduce weight by 15% by 2017. This would require wholesale changes on the whole car and truck line. He says it seems rather optimistic in that time frame.
Yeah, it's probably an optimistic number, but all of a sudden, between magnesium, aluminum, high-strength steel, you look at some of the numbers right now,
people are
getting 10% reductions.
You're right. But GM's got heavy cars.
That's
so for
true.
It to get a 15% reduction is probably not that hard. And I'd also point out the ATS is the leader of the pack when it comes to lightweight in the segment.
How much did they reduce it again? I mean, it was a lot of weight.
It was about 150 pounds lighter than the lightest 3 Series.
Yeah.
And what impressed me the most
probably
about that car...
Probably 250 to 300 pounds lighter than what GM would have built it the old way.
Right. But what impressed me the most is it's not necessarily an aluminum-intensive car. There's some really cool aluminum applications.
We've got a lot of AHSS, so ultra-high-strength steels in
the
it.
The bigger thing is, remember, I want to say, God, it was in like the late 90s, Porsche did a body-in-white study for the American Iron and Steel Institute of how to take weight out of a car without even getting into a whole lot of HHS steel.
Right.
But simply tailor blanks, you know, trimming out all the flanges, and that's what Cadillac really emphasized was everything's at, right, all the suspension forces go in at direct angles into the body, not off at a little bit of an angle where you had to gusset this and put a bracket and, you know, extra weld. And so they got most of their weight reduction simply by designing steel out of it rather than substitution.
To your point, the ATS, one of the things that they made a point at the preview when they were showing us all the construction methods that they used, a lot of that had to do with thinking how to eliminate the braces and brackets And you heard that with the Corvette. They're going to go to the convertible without having to do all sorts of bracing. The most recent SL. A lot of the cars are taking the weight out simply by thinking through how they engineer the forces, to your point.
Right. Well, remember, we had Mark Royce on the show 3 years ago, and he was just talking about when they design a section in GM, it's like twice as big and heavy for the same section that they would do at Honda.
Right. Yeah.
And I say twice as, he didn't say twice as much, but it was
big. It was over-engineered.
Over-engineered.
And
right.
I think the only way you're going to be able to take weight out is a couple ways, but you can only do it with new platforms. Anybody who says, well, I can do it in the middle of a program is crazy, because you can't get the economies of scale, you can't get the tooling payback. You got to do it at the beginning. Because what happens, if we go back to the Ford example, you take all this aluminum or all this weight out of the vehicle, now you can re-engineer the braking system, the suspension system, because it's kind of like when your doctor says, Mike, you need to lose weight because your knees can't take it anymore. And now if I lose weight, my knees are going, hey, I'm a lot happier now. But it's the same thing. It's the same thing with the vehicle. So.
That's good. Okay. Scott Vander Kirkhoff says, ask Paul how he likes the Rolls-Royce Phantom he got to drive.
It was a fun car, but talk about weight, talk about mass. I mean,
right. The Rolls, 5,000 pounds?
55, isn't it? Hmm. I mean, the Rolls-Royce, the Phantom, to me, is exactly the wrong car. It's a special niche, and it's thumbing your nose at the world and saying, look what I'm driving. It's the wrong car, but I guess there is a market for it, and it's fun to drive it.
Rum and Coke wants to know, is the ATS selling well?
Starting to.
I think it's like we were saying earlier, it's going to have to catch on. It's one of these vehicles that will have to catch on.
Mm-hmm. Cadillac had a great month last month in the American market. I want to say their sales were up 25%, I'm going by memory. And the big contributors to the jump in Cadillac sales were both the ATS and the XTS.
Yes.
There's no question that the CTS sales have suffered with the ATS coming
in. It's the wrong
CTS. But
if
you add ATS and CTS together, they're greater than what CTS alone was a year ago.
But it's the end of the cycle, and the people who are savvy, and that type of buyer is, knows that this is a tweener car and that there's a different CTS coming. The real test for me, for Cadillac in the midterm, maybe not long term, will be what the reception is to the CTS that we see in New York in 3 weeks?
Yeah.
2 weeks?
Sean Sweeney, this is for you, Michael. He says, seeing that your responsibilities include global sales, production and capacity forecasting dynamics, future vehicle product program intelligence, he says, we need 2015 Mustang info.
It's funny. I had a friend of mine call me yesterday and wonder a little bit more about it. I think the vehicles, obviously, we're getting away from the older platform. We're going to be working off of a new structure. So that allows Ford a lot of capability to really lighten up the vehicle. I think it's going to be a lot more global. They're going to be able to, they'll stuff a four banger in it. I think, we wouldn't be talking out of turn. And by doing that, you now allow for many more markets to look at that vehicle as a possibility.
What type of four banger, though? I mean, you look at the Alpha 4C, it's going to have, 275 horsepower? Four.
Right.
Fours aren't the same as they used to be. So
No.
You give me a four in some cars, I'm happy as a clam.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think Ford knows that, too.
Sure. Look, the EcoBoost stuff drives brilliantly, even though I've complained about some of the real-world fuel economy in the sub-2-liter versions. They drive great.
I drove the 1-liter recently, and I was like, wow. You have to work the gear quite a bit.
But at the bottom end, I mean, low speeds, the low-end grunt in that thing is really good.
Yeah. I had the 2-liter turbo with the Taurus. Yeah, Taurus is a heavy vehicle.
Yeah.
And it wasn't bad at all. I really didn't notice that much that it was
only a four-cylinder. Ooh, I got to drive that.
I was actually pleasantly surprised.
I didn't know they had it.
Yeah.
Paul, you just mentioned the New York show. Brian says, I know we're just fresh from Geneva, but anything to look towards in the upcoming New York show?
I haven't had a chance to really look. One thing we got our T's on today was the new Equus. Yeah, and of course we have the CTS. CTS is going to be, if it's a good car, that'll be likely. I don't know if you guys agree. I think that could be one of the stars of the
show.
It'll
be an important vehicle.
It'll be important. It'll either be a yawner and you go, oh, there they go again. They start getting momentum and they blow it. I don't think so. I think this time, from everything I hear,
They really have finally figured out where the positioning of the products go.
I'm anxious to see what Hyundai does with Equus. And
yeah, agreed.
I'm really, really anxious.
Have you've seen the teaser shot?
I saw the teaser. I'm sick of these teaser shots, though, yeah. I tell you.
The good here's a good thing about the teaser. I put it up this morning on the Detroit Bureau, and I took the image. Now, sometimes the stuff comes through, and you can't play with it. This picture, they simply just Photoshopped it down. So I just Photoshopped it back up.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, take a look.
Oh, I have to check that out.
So, I mean, you can see a lot of detail. And I didn't take it all the way up. I didn't want to get them too mad. But you can see a lot of detail in the shot. Oh,
very interesting. Jay Cujo says, Chrysler brand has only 3 models right now. And when the Town and Country goes away, that only leaves 2 models. Are we seeing the end of the Chrysler brand?
No.
And is it Town and Country going away, or is it?
I don't even think they know. I think, to tell you the truth, it would not surprise me if there's still 2.
It wouldn't surprise me
at all.
How can you walk away from so much volume? I don't see how you can do it, especially as you keep pointing out, Peter. They make so much money on that thing.
They're not walking away. They're just trying to find how they can do 2 and stop making them essentially identical.
Mm-hmm.
And one, they're going to call one a people mover. They'll be differentiated.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing that Marchionne gets, differentiation.
But, you know, Jay Cujo makes a good point here. Only 3 models in the Chrysler brand.
Yeah.
Let's remember, there are no standalone Chrysler dealers. They're going to be with a Ram, or they're going to be with a Jeep or something. So while I hear what he's saying, it's not so much that they're standing alone like Lincoln was a couple of years ago when there were just a Lincoln and you only had a couple of vehicles on the lot. It's not quite the same.
You still need more product than that.
Yeah, and there probably will be.
George from Brooklyn wants to know, do they even use catalytic converters in China?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're
all this
E4, E5. They're at least, actually, some are being engineered for Euro 6 at some point.
A couple of years, by the way, 5 years ago, I'm not sure if everything met that level. And that's part of the problem, is that we think of China, it's the world's largest automotive market, which, of course, includes non-passenger vehicles. But it has come on so strong. I think you were with me on one of the trips, the early trips to China, John, and it wasn't all that many years ago. The Chinese market has done in barely a decade what Korea did in 20 years and Japan did in 40. And part of the problem is that there were a lot of vehicles out in the early years that essentially didn't have pollution controls. I mean,
you mentioned commercial vehicles too, and a lot of them really need to come up to snuff. That's one area where China needs to improve.
Yeah, absolutely.
The commercial vehicle side.
Okay. This is good for rapid fire right now. I'm just curious. I want to ask you guys. We did a poll this week on AutoLine Daily asking our viewers, how many cylinders do you have in your household? So cars, you know, motorcycles, weed whackers, snow blowers, whatever it happens to be, how many cylinders in your household? And just to give you an idea where we are with our readers right now, the average is 25. Here, Ben's got all the stats up on the screen.
Wow.
The median is 20. The total cylinders that we're up to right now is 15,187. One viewer has only one cylinder, and another viewer has 304.
Oh, my God. Is that a car dealer?
Or somebody with a collection.
Yeah, exactly. Oh.
So I'm figuring in my household, 3 cars, a tractor, a push mower, a weed whacker, and a chainsaw. So 12, I got 16 cylinders in my household. So, Michael, how many you got?
I've got 22. 3 cars, a lawnmower, a generator, and a snowblower.
Well, it depends on which week. How many cars do I have in my driveway?
Well, just
pick
this week.
All right, we're taking it. Oh, well, this week, let's see. Hybrid 4, like about 15.
15 cylinders. Again, Peter, what do you
have?
6 cylinders.
That's it. By the way,
that's 1 car. Yeah.
By the way, that includes 2 press vehicles.
Yeah. So just kind of interesting. I mean, what a great conversation starter.
That's a good line.
That's a good one. Well, hey, guys, we're at the top of the hour here, so we'll wrap it up. But Michael Robinette, great seeing you, man. Thanks for coming on.
Well.
Yeah, Paul, thanks for coming right from Geneva here.
This is
awesome. This was really good. And Peter, as always, man.
Thanks, John.
Good having you, and we ought to do this more often.
We didn't say how much the 4C is overpriced.
Oh, what is the price?
What is the price? We don't know. In Europe, they're talking 60,000 euros, 78,000 plus.
It's going to be 80 grand here.
If it does, I think that's going to be really difficult. You're starting to push almost into GTR territory.
And they're calling it a supercar, and I'm sorry. It's not a supercar.
It's almost
a compelling power to weight ratio.
Yeah. Compelling power to weight ratio, but.
And it's a cool looking car, and it is a lot of carbon fiber. You know what? We'll have to wait and see what their aspirations are.
Oh, their aspirations are, it's going to be their halo and it'll all be good, but I'm not buying it.
How many do you think they'll sell?
They're bringing 1,000 over here.
Will they sell 1,000?
I don't know.
I question what dealers are going to sell them at. Chrysler dealers aren't used to selling 80,000.
Oh, it'll be the vast Fiat Chrysler network.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be fascinating to watch. But anyway, I want to thank you all for having been on the show. I want to thank all of you for having watched, and we'll be signing off for right now.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.